how to get WPFW swag in your life? Items that say, I support Jazz and Justice without saying a word. We've got you covered. Details and browsing at WPFWFM.org. Again, that's WPFWFM.org.
Yo, peace, this is Rod Stars.
Peace, this is G1, and together we're Rebel D.I.s. When we in the DMV, you know we listening to that People Power Radio, WPFW Washington, your station for jazz and justice. Let's go.
This is a journey.
I got so much trouble on my mind. Refuse to lose. Here's your ticket.
He is amazing. I didn't know nothing about it.
I don't want to be like Mike.
Say what you say. Say what?
I don't want to be like Mike.
Before Magic's knees go permanently south for the winter.
I don't want to be like Mike.
Changing up the guard quicker than fear brings down doo-doo.
With the finger roll, plus the foul.
Hey, young bro.
He never saw Elgin Baylor play during his day or Oscar Robinson.
Flash the dice roll back. The big O was jackknifing through all them bodies.
I didn't know nothing about it.
Welcome, welcome, welcome to the collision. This is the part where I say he's Etan Thomas, I'm Dave Zirin, he's Chuck Modiano, I'm Dave Zirin. Etan Thomas played in the NBA for 10 years. Chuck Modiano did not play in the NBA, unlike myself, who has been to some NBA games. That's as close as I got to the action. But Etan Thomas is not here with us this week. He's on a family trip. He's got some athletic children he needs to travel with. But I'm so thrilled to be with Chuck Modiano because we have more than a few things to discuss at the intersection of sports and politics. How you doing, Chuck?
I'm doing great. If it means anything, I watched Etan Thomas play in the NBA alongside Mr. Michael Jordan on the Wizards.
You know what's a funny story about Etan that I just like to tell that I haven't told folks is all I knew him as was a great player at Syracuse. I was like, oh, that guy blocked shots. That guy's a real player. And then there was an article in Sports Illustrated about him as a rookie going to these small D.C. poetry slams and reading powerful poems about the death penalty. And I was very active in the campaign to end the death penalty then. And I'll never forget thinking to myself, wow, he'd be a good person to know. And
sort of
doing it wistfully, like wistfully, because at the time there were a lot of down low political NBA players at the turn of the 20th century. You know, people might not even remember as being political, like Josh Howard, who is 1 year an all-star for the Dallas Mavericks. Or Ira Knubel, who was a political dude who played for the Cleveland Cavaliers and maybe the only NBA player in history named Ira. I will have to look that up, maybe in the 1940s or something. There was an Ira. He was a man of African descent named Ira. I don't know how common that is, but he was an amazing guy. But I was always cataloging these guys, Adalius Thomas in the NFL. Yep. I was like, oh, gee, be fun to know him too, you know, because I was just getting started. And so I was just keeping track of everybody. And I sent an email to the Wizards. I was doing this a lot to different and just saying like, hey, I'm with the campaign of the and the death penalty. I didn't even rep myself as a sports writer and said, I'm going to do a panel in Tacoma Park at this church. Do you want to come out and speak? And sure enough, he did.
And is that how you got started with Etan?
Sure was. And I barely even got to talk to him because at the time, you know, he had a lot of much less than now. You know, Etan was maybe 22 years old. He had a lot of people around him. You know, he had like his friends from high school and making sure nobody took advantage of him. You know, typical young sure. NBA player stuff. And so I barely got to talk to him that night. But we did get to talk enough for me to tell him that I wrote about sports for the Prince George's Post. And then I think you know the story from here. He got in touch with me and said, hey, I'm also against this war that George W. Bush is starting, and I wanted to talk about it with the Washington Post and the Washington Times, and they both wouldn't talk to me about it. So I thought maybe we could talk, and I was like, yes.
That's a great story.
That's how we really got to know each other.
But listen, we have to pause for a second. We have to pause because we can't tell that story enough and every opportunity we need to tell it. Because he went to the New York Times and went
No,
to
the Washington Times. The Washington Times.
Oh, the Washington Times.
And the Washington Post.
And the Washington Post. And said a pro athlete saying why they're against the war. And they said no. And then they went to you at the Prince George's Gazette?
Prince George's Post.
Prince George's Post. I'm really messing up my paper.
No relation to the Washington Post. At the time, the only black-owned newspaper in all of Prince George's County, which is interesting.
So in a way, you broke back in maybe like 2003. You broke one of the biggest athlete stories for the simple fact that the big papers refused to publish an athlete who, and as they were, you know, probably bought in with the military-industrial complex, which we have seen in the last 20 years.
And that's important to say because while Jeff Bezos deserves every bit of criticism for what he's done to the Washington Post, he's really destroyed a generation of Washington Post journalists as well, some who have very good hearts, because everything they write, I know this for a fact, people now read it as kind of fruit from a poison tree. Like, oh, how is Bezos influencing this? How is this part of that? You know, and then when you see some of the editorials they've been running, good gracious. And when you see the people quitting in protest, and when you see, this one's my personal favorite, after the mass demonstrations a couple of weeks ago that we went to, that I know a lot of people don't read, you know, the physical paper anymore, but so call me a fossil if you will. But the lower half of the front page mentioned the protests. The upper half was a profile of a former Obama voter who is now, you know, for Trump and is saying, she says, quote, just burn it all down, is what she said. And that's the big story, according to the Washington Post. Some rando speaking about burning it all down when you know and I know what it means. It does not mean her life. That's for darn sure.
That's right.
It means the parts of the government that actually help people, cancer research, stuff that advances the rights of people of color, civil rights protections. We know the big news yesterday of Trump trying to claw back the Civil Rights Act, which people like you and I and so many others, my friend Jesse Hagopian out in Seattle, I think was the first person I saw say this, who said, whoa, DEI, huh? They're going after DEI? That means they're going after the 64 Civil Rights Act. That's all that means.
Right. That's
now a common discussion, and now we're seeing it in practice. But I remember Jesse saying it from jump and me being sort of like, no.
Yeah.
They would not dare. That is sacrosanct.
They wouldn't dare do that. Well, nothing is sacrosanct, including the Civil Rights Act. And, you know, you hear this in the white nationalist right, which is now mainstream. You're Charlie Kirk's, right, who want to repeal the Civil Rights Act. And I think we got to be clear about this, you know, when I see it, even the Gavin Newsom, you know, buddying up and cajoling Charlie Kirk and talking about how his son loves him. That is a major problem. See, part of the problem is we know this Trump agenda or the Charlie Kirk agenda, the white nationalist agenda. And we have to make sure that we are clear. That is not something you buddy up with, you compromise with, that you capitulate to in any way or more complicit with. And we have to make sure about that. We make sure we do that.
No, that's right. And, you know, one thing we have so much to talk about at the intersection of sports and politics, namely tonight is the NFL draft, which is going to capture the attention of the sports world. And you and I know we want to do a political analysis of what the NFL draft represents, not some like, who are the Browns going to take at number two? Like that, that's less interesting to us than the politics of it. Although I think we do want to talk about Shedeur Sanders.
Yeah.
Every darn draft, there is some sort of referendum on a quarterback who invariably is a black quarterback.
Yeah.
Last year it was Caleb Williams, and it was, you know, can this person actually do it because of, and then they list off all of their personal foibles that, that usually involve them being an individual and not a robot. Yeah.
That's right.
Yeah. And, you know, all props to the Jedi in Washington, Jaden Daniels, but it might have been him last year, except the existence of Caleb Williams, DC's own Caleb Williams, I have to add, acted as the kind of, for lack of a better term, meat shield for the black quarterbacks in that draft. Like, but there's always one who is the pile on.
Yeah.
And this year it is easily, and of course, Shedeur Sanders, and who has definitely put his chin out there to be piled onto, which I respect actually very much. But we're going to get to that as well. We have so much to get to. But, you know, one of the things that I think is very important to all of us here at, and one other thing I want to say that we want to talk about as well is I am extremely serious about this one, Chuck. And I want to offer, and I know you're going to agree with me, and I apologize for not talking to you about it, but I feel like you and I share a brain so much, it's like this is not going to be controversial. But I want to offer all the solidarity in the world. Maybe she is listening right now. And if she is, I want her to know that we have her back. And I am talking about the wife, the partner of Kilmar Abrejo Garcia.
That's right.
And her name, just so everybody knows it, I want to read out her name because I want to say her name because she deserves it. Jennifer Vasquez Sura. Now, people may have heard this, but she has started to speak out for Kilmar. She has gotten over the very understandable fear factor, and she's been at rallies. She's spoken to the press. She wants to be able to have people know that Kilmar Abrejo Garcia belongs with his family, two of whom are special needs kids who need him. And she has been putting that out there. So what does the Department of Homeland Security do? Did you hear this, Chuck?
Go ahead. Tell us.
They posted a statement to their 2.4 million followers on Elon Musk's Nazi creation machine, otherwise known as X, listing her home address. And since they listed her home address, she had was subject to all sorts of harassment, and she's had to be moved to a safe house.
Wow.
For her protection. And this is what she said to the Washington Post, and I'm going to read this. I don't feel safe when the government posts my address, the house where my family lives, for everyone to see, especially when this case has gone viral. So this is definitely a bit terrifying. I'm scared for my kids.
This is Gestapo stuff.
Yeah, and the DHS, you know, they're not even trying to hide behind the whole, it was a mistake, you know, like with Harvard. You know, they said, oh, we didn't mean to send a letter saying we were going to stop billions of dollars from coming to your school. That was a mistake. you know, they've been doing that a lot lately. Whoops, as a political response to their horribleness. But in this case, they utterly shrugged it off and said, well, these are public documents that anyone could get access to. As if that's the same thing, as if people know how to do that, as opposed to just looking at their X feed, which you know and I know, a lot of people look at that and see them more as marching orders than they do a random tweet by DHS.
No, that's ridiculous. This is Gestapo stuff, and it is what it is, and it's disgusting. It's absolutely disgusting, and you know, in D.C., we say we keep us safe. Who keep us safe? We keep us safe. It's a big chant at all protests. And we have to, more than ever, start thinking about, you know, how we keep us safe. When I hear Homeland Security is doxing her, when I see videos of abductions without a warrant, without any ID, and just based threats, we don't know who... if that person is, and we've seen this multiple times, and we really have to start thinking about what happens when we do that, and the people around what we do, and how we surround that person. We don't even know if what's going on is legal, and I don't mean legal in the sense like unconstitutional. I mean, we know it's illegal right then and there because there's no ID, no badge, and no warrant. So this is Gestapo times, and we have to have a reaction that where we keep us safe.
Yeah, and you know, I certainly am not going to speak for WPFW. I'm not going to speak for the show. I'm not going to speak for you, Chuck. I'm going to say out there that there are already networks of people. I'm just saying I would be proud to join them to nonviolently help protect people who are in situations like this, willing to put our bodies forward to protect folks like this. I'm on some groups that are just nonviolently saying that if we need to keep people safe, if we need to stand in front of people's homes, if we need to hold press conferences like she's doing, you know, to announce this attack, which I think is incredibly brave on her part because it only amps the publicity of what's happening with her life. Right. We just want her to know that I want her to know that I've got her back. And I know I speak for you, Chuck, on that.
Absolutely.
But I know. That's why I said we share a brain. But I digress because it's 15 after the hour. You and I want to talk about the NFL draft.
Yep.
I really want to talk about why Kawhi Leonard is keeping me sane these days with everything happening in the world.
15 to 19. That's right.
That's special. That's special. And I have a political thing to go with that. But first and foremost, I'm very excited. First of all, I'm honored to have a show on Pacifica Radio. I'm honored to have a show with WPFW, which I think is the jewel of the Pacifica Radio family. I'm allowed to say that. I don't know if our war chief is allowed to say that, but I'd like to bring her on right now to speak about what is how we are commemorating the 48th anniversary of WPFW, which is this Friday. Let me bring her on right now. So honored always to have her on the show. Frankly, nice to not have her on the show during Fun Drive and have her on the show in another means. But please, to speak about the 48th anniversary of WPFW and how we will commemorate, I'm thrilled to bring on the show Katia Stitt.
Ooh, I don't even know if I can say anything that will make me seem as inspired as you just made me seem.
No, you are inspiring.
Well, no, Dave, you are. And I think you can speak for PFW. We all would stand in front of her. God bless her. As a woman, I read it this morning. I don't know what it's like not to be able to keep your children safe. And I know that's not why you have me on the show, but it infuriates me to no end. And every woman, I don't care what you think politically. I don't care who you voted for politically. If you're a mother trying to keep your children safe, and you don't get what you need to be doing in this moment, I don't know what to think of you. I don't know. There might be some revocation happening because every one of us should be worried about this situation and stand up. And actually, there used to be a group here called Tacoma Park Mobilization. I don't know if they still do it or not, where they would go to homes and stand in between ICE or whomever and folks that they were trying to secure and deport. So that's the time we're in. It's no more like, again, first they came for the communists. This is where we're at. We all need to be standing strong. And that does lead me into our 48th anniversary, because if any of the founders, Denise Oliver is still alive. She's in New York. Sagidi Browdy, he is down in, Grace Cavalieri is with us. Sagidi's in DR. Grace is in Annapolis. But any of these founding folks would say that we are here 48 years for just this. This is the vision that they upheld. This is what they did when they began it. And this is what we will continue to do. And the beautiful thing is, unlike NPR, PBS, yes, we're calling their names, unlike public radio in this country, Pacifica, and certainly I can speak very knowledgeably about WPFW, does not take a dime of other money. It is the people's money that has power, that has fueled. So when we are able to talk about Kumar's case or Ramesh's case or anyone's case, right, the young man that was killed in the prison, horribly killed by 10 policemen jumping him, 10 policemen. When we are able to talk about that, give context to it, not the sound bite, not talk about it today, forget about it tomorrow as it never existed. The people's dollars do that work. And so we know tomorrow night it's going to be a fabulous celebration. We also know it is an expensive celebration, but it is a fundraiser. And this is where I want to implore you. People can do a few things. You can do as some of my esteemed colleagues here have done, and purchase not only your own tickets, but tickets for others, and donate them and say, hey, if there's someone that needs a ticket, I got them. I'm going to purchase four. I only need two. Give the other two to people that want to come but can't afford it. You yourself can show up and just be in the house. You can decide to give another donation when you get there. It's going to be an evening of solidarity. You know, we don't just do a party here. We have our own Zain El Amin reading poetry, Lebanese poet, scholar. He's the host of Shaiwanana Minta Tea, activist. In the encampments, he and Irene Callis were faculty advisors to the encampments that we saw here at GW. So again, in the struggle, we have our own Esther Iverum, producer of On the Ground, and another activist coming together. And then, if that's not enough, we are honoring some folks that really need to be honored. Chief among them, our own Von Martin, who literally dropped the needle. And he told me that we're right on time with the anniversary, because we always thought it was February. But he sent me a message saying that actually February, we went on part-time. We couldn't stay on the station. I mean, we weren't 24 hours a day. April 21st, 1977, we became 24 hours a day. And so I know he's a fountain. So you get to, you know, we all get to see Vaughn and bask in all that he knows. And talk about a liberatory person, you know, for the Caribbean, a Pan-Africanist. So he is receiving our Jazz and Justice Award, which is our Lifetime Achievement Award, if you will, for all the good work he's done for the station, both inside and out. We also honor the legacy of Askia Muhammad, who was not only a world-class journalist, but an activist to the end, and an artist, an award-winning poet. So we have an award called the Askia Muhammad Art and Activism Award, which will be bestowed upon Ayanna Gregory. And if anyone knows Ayanna, you know she's at every protest, every rally, anything to lift the people up, to fortify them. And she does it all across the country, working with young people, changing their minds, going, you know, from the hood to the holler, just going where the people need her to make sure that a liberatory message is shared with love and conviction and artistry. So we will be awarding her and honoring her. And then we have something called the Lauren Kress Love Award, who Lauren, for those of you who know, he's founding member of WPFW. She was the program director. She was a GM. She was also a member of SNCC in the early days. And she recounts a terrifying story of being in a car driving back from some rally in Mississippi. She is a little Black girl, that's what she said, in a car with four white men. And they stop her. Someone in the road, they start there are two cars following. One is a police car. One is a regular car, you know, an unmarked car. They follow them. It's dead of night. It's like 10, 11 o'clock at night. No one is on these roads, back southern roads, dark. They stop them. They flash the light in the car and they see her. And, you know, of course they proceed, you know, what y'all doing with this, you know, like that. She said it was an amazing, like the way those men, those young men protected her, but also they all were so shaken. They made it back to where they were staying that night. And they were just shaken. They could have lost their lives, you know, that night. And so she's a real one, the all of her life. She's a Pan-Africanist. She believes in the liberatory and the liberation of all people and has always upheld that, even towards the end of her life, you know, and always centered WPFW and reminded us of what we should be doing. So if she were here, she'd be talking about Kim Marr. She'd be saying we weren't doing enough, quite frankly. You know what I mean? Because that's who she was, and that was a vision she held for WPFW. So we have the Lauren Kress Love Award for Civil Rights, and we are bestowing it. And this is an intergenerational award to honor both the young activist she was in SNCC, but how throughout her life and even her older years, opening and founding and supporting a school for Black children in Chicago, for instance, you know, and one of the many things that she was involved in the later years of her life. So this is an intergenerational award given to a veteran activist. And in this case, it'll be Dr. Joyce Ladner, the sister of Dori Ladner, for her work in SNCC. And she will be with us. We're very excited, you know, and she's so cute. She's like, why don't you give it to Dori? I said, Dori got enough. We need you. You know, she was just really, and then she was like, okay, well, I guess that's okay. I said, yeah, it's okay. And Dory's smiling right now. So she will be with us tomorrow evening. And then there's a young dynamic woman also coming out of Sunflower County who's still working there and works on the site of one of the Freedom Schools. It's called the Freedom Project Network that she runs for young Mississippians, again, a liberatory organization. And her name is LaToysha Brown. And she just is carrying on. She's the through line from the work that Lauren and Dori and Joyce were doing and so many others were doing in Mississippi. She is that embodiment. She is that through line. So the award will also be bestowed upon her, although she is unable to be with us tomorrow night. So it's going to be a full night. But let us remember that as much as we come together and we're going to have a good time and cut a rug and finger pop, as my mother used to say, all that, remember, it is in the service of getting free and making sure that we have a medium like WPFW that can stand strong, 10 toes down against the oppressor. That is why you support us. And that is why we hope to see many of you tomorrow night. You can go to our website, WPFW.fm, for more information. Say hello, you know. Dave and Chuck will be there as well. So many programmers will be there, and we just want to see you. And you know, there's nothing like the people being able to say to you in person, you know, thank you, good job, or tell us what you don't like. We all open to that too. We want to get better. We want to change, you know, whatever we need to do. But we do have to make sure that we center liberation, and we have to center truth in reporting. We have to center fact-based journalism. We have to center music that liberates mind, body, and spirit. You know what they say, you free your mind and what follows? So that's
your backside, I believe.
Your backside follows, that's right. So thank you for giving us the time to big up the 48th. We're really excited.
I love it. I'm thrilled. Yeah, this is gonna be fantastic.
Yeah, and
so important.
It really will be. And rest in power, Dori Ladner, who passed last year. Honestly, one of my very excited moments was being with a small group who got to eat a lunch with her. And we're all just all sitting there listening to stories and asking questions. What is it like in registering voters in Mississippi during Freedom Summer? And what are you dealing with? And when I think about, you know, the times we're in now, and you're thinking about a Dori Ladner, and you're thinking about many of the individuals that Katia was just mentioning. We've been here before. We don't want to go back in any way, but we do have some blueprints to look at about that could inform how we move forward with individuals who are working under much harsher conditions than we were. And I think we want to pull from that history and learn from that history and apply it today.
Very well said, Chuck.
I just want to say one quick thing to that, Chuck. I said the same thing the other day. We got the civil rights movement as a blueprint. You know what I mean? We love to talk about how glorious it was, but no one wants to talk about that was because people stayed out in the street. They were arrested in the hundreds day after day after day. They put their children on the front line to face dogs. That's what we're talking about. We got the blueprint. We got the blueprint. Yeah. So what are we going to do with it is the question. And Joyce is going to give us the answer tomorrow night.
Katia, you're hyping me up, right? I'm feeling inspired right now.
Yeah, that's amazing. And Katia, I, as you well know, I am going to be going to this event coming from a maximum security prison in Pennsylvania.
Yeah.
I'm going to, and I'm just going to say a brief thing about this. I don't want to overpub it in any way, shape, or form.
No, pub it. I think it's incredible because, you know, so you know, Mumia,
you're saying what it is.
I'm sorry.
I haven't said what it is yet.
I'm sorry. Okay. But PFW was there from the beginning, though. That's what I'm telling. That's what I'm saying. Go ahead.
Yeah. Oh, man. Katia, you stepped on my punchline. It's not a punchline. You know what I mean. But I am going to be interviewing Mumia Abu-Jamal. And we'll see how that goes. You know, it's even if it is never published, it's just for me to be able to go there and offer him solidarity and speak with him. That's beyond worth it.
That's
so
amazing.
I don't want to overstate where it can go.
Please give us and tell him all of PFW, the whole PFW family has been with him from the beginning of this ordeal, and we remain with him.
Are you kidding me? Of course I'm going to say that. Absolutely. So we and Katia, the support of WPFW, not just for freedom fighters like Mumia, but also for the work of people like Atan, Chuck, and me is something that I'll always hold close to my heart, which is definitely why I'll be there Friday night and definitely why as soon as I get a little bit cleared on the old credit card, I'm going to buy a couple extra tickets so other folks can go who can't afford it.
That's beautiful.
Beautiful.
And while you're – go ahead, Katia.
No, I was saying beautiful. Thank you. I'm going to be quiet now, y'all, and let you do your thing.
Because,
you
know, I can just
hang with you all the
doing.
Time, but I'm going to be quiet now. Listen, thank you both.
Let's go to a break right now. It is 10:32, and I know Magic Mike is itching for the station break. We're going to go to a break, but when we come back, your annual – political analysis of the NFL draft. We'll be back right after this on The Collision. WPFW trying to change that world one broadcast at a time. KRS-One, what's the name of the track there, Magic Mike?
The Sound You Miss.
Oh, you better believe every time KRS is not putting out new music, I do miss it. I told you, Chuck Modiano, the eyes of the sports world with shockingly high ratings, people who are not sports fans who are listening to our show, and I know we've got them, may not realize high ratings for tonight's first round of the NFL draft coming to you live from Green Bay, Wisconsin, for some reason. where thousands of people, maybe more people than the population of Green Bay, will show up to watch people say who their team is going to pick with big waits in between picks. I mean, as a television spectacle, it's really not much of anything. But for an NFL fan, I really think it ranks third between the Super Bowl, opening day, and this, Thursday night opening day, and this, the draft. And maybe the draft even ahead of that opening Thursday night game. I'm always stunned by the popularity of this, Chuck. Are you, or have you ever been what they call a draft Nick?
I'm not a draft Nick. I am not a draft Nick. I'll often watch the first round and I'll go back and forth to NBA playoffs and whatnot, but I'm not a draft Nick. I mean, we're selecting people and it's far bigger than it needs to be. And then we have to maybe explore why that is. Yeah, I'm sure you have done a lot of exploration. Let me ask you, why is it? Why is the NFL draft such a spectacle? The selection of a draft pick. What do you think?
Well, there are a couple. It's so funny, Chuck, because if you look at the NFL has such turnover as to who gets into the playoffs, you have to actually be a terribly mismanaged team to not make it year after year. I think our Washington Commanders are such proof of this, that as soon as they got decent management, it's like, oh, look, they're in the NFC championship game.
Yeah.
You see, you have to be very, very poorly managed to be bad year after year, or even be mediocre year after year. So in a lot of respects, the tragedy of the draft is that we've seen this more than once. Very good players drafted by very bad teams, only to find their careers stymied, if not entirely wasted, because of the team that picks them. It's becoming a running joke that the best way to find a decent quarterback in the NFL is just sign whoever the New York Jets are releasing, because they've done so badly developing their own players, talking about Geno Smith, Sam Darnold, and heck, who knows, maybe even Zach Wilson.
I'll tell you what, and people are going to disagree, but I would kick the tires on Zach Wilson, because like Geno and like Sam Darnold, he was playing mostly under the 30th ranked offensive line. And you're not going to throw a rookie quarterback under the 30th ranked offensive line and not give that person a second chance.
It's also coaching. It's also not trying to assess whether somebody may or may not be ready for a kind of New York City environment. It's also being under the auspices of a franchise owner in Woody Johnson, who lets his teenage kids make decisions for him. I mean, only Woody, a Trump.
Hold on, pause on that one. He let his teenage kids make his decisions for him?
Yeah, this has been much commented upon and criticized in the New York press.
Yeah.
Is that he turns to the teenagers as to who should be drafted, which means he gets terrible picks, which means the brain trust of the team. You can't really hire good people because no one wants to be in a situation like that. And Woody Johnson is a Trumpist of the first order, maybe the only person on earth who can make Aaron Rodgers sympathetic. It's like really, like that's a short list, man.
Yeah.
That is a short list.
So,
this is where we're at with some of these teams. So I always view the NFL draft as kind of a sad spectacle of wasted talent, because it's always the teams at the top of the draft are not the ones who cycle through the playoffs when there's so much turnover as to that's who right. make the playoffs. The Tennessee Titans, the hideously run New York Giants, the Cleveland Browns, this is who's at the top of your draft board. And goodness gracious, if I would, this is also, though, I do have to say, what can create greatness? Because if Caleb Williams, to use last year's example and also to shout out DC, if Caleb Williams can make the Bears, who haven't had a good quarterback since Sid Luckman in the 1930s. Sid Luckman, who, you know, God bless him, as a proud Jewish man, I'll tell you, you know, maybe our last great Jewish football player.
Yeah.
Because the Jews were coming from the poor ranks, and that's who that's always right. become the pro athletes.
That was so, back when you had Jewish boxers all over the place.
Big time. Yeah. Big time. And Max Baer being a great example of that. But you deal with somebody like a Sid Luckman as your all-time best quarterback, and gee, he only played a century ago. That's where Caleb Williams is going. So if Caleb Williams can elevate that franchise, wow, that's an all-time great right there. But more often than not, that's not what happens.
No.
More often than not, you get the squandered, wasted talent as great players go to awful teams.
It's so true what you're saying. And, you know, in Jets circles, I would hear this comment, oh, I wish that we didn't draft Sam Darnold. I wish we drafted Lamar Jackson. And my response to that is, if the Jets had drafted Lamar Jackson, he would be a wide receiver right now.
Dang. Well, he would have quit before that happened, because Lamar and his mom, who is his agent, were so hardcore about that. They were so hardcore, they didn't have Lamar run the 40-yard dash. Now that's kind of typical. At the combine, some guys are just like, yeah, I'm not running that. I'll be doing it on my college track where I'm comfortable, and maybe where the person doing the timing might have a bit of an itchy finger. Give me that extra tenth of a second. Lamar wouldn't run it because he was like, it will be used against me as a quarterback. Lamar, a draft revolutionary. But then there's the other side to it too, Chuck, about what do we even think about a system that tells these young men where they have to live and where they have to play? Like, if you're Cam Reed, who's going to be at the top of this draft and go to the hideous Tennessee Titans, if you're that man, why can't you say, you know what, I will be so much better developed on the San Francisco 49ers, where I can learn under Kyle Shanahan, or, you know, another one of the Shanahan tree guys like McVay and the Rams, if that's his choice. I know you have your critiques of that particular nepotistic tree, but why? I'm just using that as an example of guys who've had success with quarterbacks. Like, why shouldn't they be allowed the freedom of the rest of us, which is to look for a job where you think you'll be best suited and take it?
You know,
and does it feed Chuck, a highly racialized spectacle where white fans can basically celebrate the, you know, very remunerative, of course, indentured servitude of a great player having to go to their cruddy team? That's my question for you.
It's a great question. It's a radical question, because we're so accustomed to the draft to the point that it's just accepted. You're going to go work here, period. But I love the question, because I think we have to, when we look at something that we accept that is on the surface wrong in an alleged free market economy, where someone can't pick the place they want to go to unless they have incredible leverage, like Eli Manning or John Elway back in the day, who said, I'm not going to be the number one pick unless I go to this team. A few people have exercised that over the years. What the sports answer will be is they'll say it wouldn't be competitive if we had free agency instead of a draft. That's what they would say. But you could argue in many ways it's more outside of football. It's hard to be competitive anyway. But it's a great question. I think about it all the time, that someone's drafted or being told or being traded. We know what the Kurt Flood said back in the day. He said, I'm a well-paid slave. And he got some incredible hate for saying that. But it was Kurt Flood that helped in baseball, by the St. Louis Cardinals, who helped change the contracts and spur free agency ultimately in the 1970s with Andy Messermith in 1975. And at that moment in time, in the late 60s, for Kurt Flood to challenge baseball's reserve clause, and that you're traded where you go and you make what you make, we said what you make, that was considered incredibly radical. It was beyond the thinking of a regular fan. You should be happy that you just make this money for playing a kid's game. Let the owners make all the money. That's what it was at the time. So I believe a conversation like we're having right now is a good conversation. It's never a wrong conversation to question something that is, seems inherently messed up to tell someone where they're going to work and who they're going to work for.
Exactly. And anybody who says in response to that, well, then the bad teams will always be bad. My response is, well, that's what's happening right now. And maybe, just maybe, these teams would hire better coaches, would pay top. There's no salary cap for coaching. Maybe they would figure out how to create a more attractive environment. Maybe the billionaire owner could pay for better facilities, for example. That's something the Jets are infamous for. Bad stadium, bad facilities. Like, maybe they would then be a more attractive place for a young college kid to go. And maybe some of these young college kids would be like, well, there's no competition on the Jets, so that's where I'm going to go. Instead of a player rolling his eyes and being like, oh my gosh, I just lost the first 6 years of my career by going to the Jets. Like, it could actually have a positive effect on some of the competitive imbalance, but they're so tied, not just to the hierarchies, Chuck, not just to the highly racialized hierarchies of the draft, but they're also so incredibly tied now to the moneymaker that is the NFL draft. I mean, this is how the NFL gets to be a year-round product, because people like you and me are talking about it in April. When you and I were growing up, it was like, oh, baseball, of course. Yeah. That's the winter, fall and winter sport. And, you know, now is NBA playoffs and the start of the major league season. You know, spring brings baseball. Uh-uh. Now all sports leagues are in a contest to say who could be 365 days. And, you know, no one's as good as that as the NFL, which is wild, given that they only have 17 games compared to these other sports, which is frankly one of the reasons it's so popular.
You're right. That is the 17 games, because every game is meaningful, right? Incredibly meaningful. But what is also an annual event that you made stated at top is the denigration of a select black athlete this year, being Shedeur Sanders, and messing with their career in what I think. So you hear an anonymous pre-draft take saying he's so entitled and talking about he's entitled, which is really code for, you know, uppity black man. And then we see this every year. And the first thing I hate about this is that it's always an anonymous, right? It's someone anonymous. If I'm a reporter, you're going to give me information, if that even happened, to harm the career of somebody, meaning they could lower their draft status and lose a lot of money. I think you need to put your name on that, first of all. I think you need to put your name on it, and that the person, the journalist who was told that, needs to have to put their name on it. Otherwise, I feel like it's probably your take, because what I hear is Shedeur Sanders, who's supposed to be a top three pick, and Matt Rhule, the coach, has gone on record saying he should be a top three pick. You're seeing a lot of articles saying he's out of the first round then.
That even Shedeur out of the first round.
Drops out of the first round. New York Post is saying it, CBS draft. Now he's out of the first round. How do you go from three to out of the first round? That is some, in my view, the annual racism that we see when a black man doesn't comply the way many of these white GMs want them.
You know, let's bring it to that for a second, because first of all, folks have to know that, if they don't know, that Shedeur Sanders is, of course, the son of Deion Sanders, who coached Shedeur both at Catholic and at HBCU before Catholic. I believe that was at Jackson State. Am I getting that? No, it was Grambling or Jackson State for Shedeur.
It was Jackson State and then Colorado, yeah.
Yeah. So what you're hearing, Chuck, is that a lot of these teams, and this is part of the issue, Chuck, are too, and this goes to our first point about maybe there shouldn't be a draft, are too insecure. That's the word being used.
Yep.
To draft Shedeur, because they're worried that Deion is waiting in the wings to take that job and coach his son, because Deion, and we're going back to junior high here, is the only coach Shedeur Sanders has ever had.
Right.
So that's the fear. But if you're a coach with security, if you're Sean McVay, to go back to that example, you're not worried about Deion taking your job because you're a Super Bowl winning coach. I mean, but if you're the Giants picking number three, all you're really doing is drafting the quarterback for a future where you're not going to be, which is feeding some of this, no question, from what I'm hearing, which is also very interesting to me. But let's take it to the racialized component and the history for a second. And correct me if I'm wrong, but there are only two instances in history of a quarterback saying, I care too much about my future, my career, and my development to go to the team with the number one pick. So you might as well trade me because I'm not going. The first was John Elway. With the Colts. The Colts were at the time owned by a comparatively poor and very inebriated Robert Irsay, infamous soon thereafter this draft, showing John Elway to be very correct for moving the team from Baltimore in the dead of night on the infamous Mayflower trucks going to Indy. John Elway would have been the face of that for the rest of his career. And you know, good news for him that didn't happen. But John Elway also, the son of Jack Elway, who was his coach at Stanford. That's interesting, right. First of all, that no one was scared. Oh, if I draft John Elway, Jack Elway will take my job. And also John Elway had a contract offer from the New York Yankees. So he was I've got leverage.
Yep.
Yeah, I don't have to do this. I've got leverage. They traded him to the Broncos. The rest is history. Worked out great for John Elway. The other example, do you want to say what it is, Chuck?
Eli Manning, son of Archie Manning and brother of Peyton Manning.
So again, not that financial imperative.
That's
that
right.
A Caleb Williams would have of, wow, you know, how much do I really want to rock the boat here? Now, Shadur is interesting to me. A lot of people thought Shadur might actually do this because he also does not have the financial imperative, being the son of Deion Sanders. You know, they have money in that family. So he has a bit of space to do it, which is why I think, Chuck, you have had all of the horrible, despite from what I hear is great workout after great workout from Shadur, because I listen to all this stuff. And every time he has a workout, what you hear is, oh, he's actually better than we thought. You know, oh, yeah. What a great workout. You know, all this stuff. And yet these rumors come out to actually take away his leverage of saying, well, I just want to play for the Steelers, for example.
Right.
Which would actually be an amazing spot for him, as much as I dislike the Steelers. Because one thing I can tell you about Mike Tomlin, he is not going to be insecure that Deion Sanders is taking his job.
That's right.
So,
that's right.
Even if it's the threat, he's not going to be insecure about it.
No, he won't. But what is consistent, and we saw this with Cam Newton, and we saw this with Geno Smith, and we saw this with other black athletes, is they go after what they believe is their character. So when the anonymous coach says he's so entitled, he takes unnecessary sacks, he never plays on time, he has horrible body language, you blame teammates. I don't want you, first of all, about that body language, they said the same thing about Cam Newton. I really don't want you deciding what someone's body language is. Now, if you want to talk about maybe someone's accuracy and you have data to put that forward, that is one thing. When I hear he's so entitled, I hear uppity black man. What does that mean, he's so entitled? Did someone say Eli Manning is so entitled coming up under Archie Manning or John Elway is so entitled? This is language just used for the black athlete, right? Or the body language is just used for the black athlete. And I think we have to call that out because it's part of the NFL draft and how they're viewing athletes. And it is affecting their salary. It is affecting millions. And then we had Laramie Tunsil years ago, who was coming to the Commanders. And years ago, just before the draft, they show him, you know, smoking on a bong. And he falls from like the top three pick to the mid round with John Gruden at the draft saying, I wouldn't pick him. I wouldn't pick Laramie Tunsil. Oh, you wouldn't, John Gruden? Because here's what happened. He became one of the greatest offensive tackles in the game. and you're out of the game because you wouldn't pick Laramie Tunsil because he had a bong that showed up the night of the draft. So we've seen this movie before.
Ah, the irony. Well, John Gruden casting judgment. Well, we people can Google that if they don't know what Chuck's referring to, because yeah. We're out of time. Chuck, so thrilled to do the show with you yet again, man,
yes. In
all sincerity. As much as we miss it, Ton, love talking to you, buddy.
One last thing, DZ. One last thing. While you were talking to Mumia, before we go to the 48th anniversary of WPFW on Friday tomorrow, there is also a global day of action for Gaza in D.C. People will meet at 4 p.m. at the State Department as part of that. So I'm heading to the State Department while you're speaking to Mumia, and then we're going to meet at the 48th anniversary of WPFW.
Sounds very good. To be very clear, we are not telling anybody to go to that protest. We are merely saying that Chuck shall be there.
And
Chuck supports this protest. And that's all we're saying.
That's it.
For everybody out there listening, for Tia Stitt, for Magic Mike, of course, for the great Chuck Modiano, I'm Dave Zirin. Stay frosty, y'all. We are out of here. Peace.
Sip the juice. Got enough to go around, and the thought takes place uptown. I grew up on a sidewalk while on street talk, and then taught the whole New York.
In commemoration of International Jazz Day, Friends of the Congo, Africa World Now Project, WPFW, and the Institute of Musical Traditions presents an evening examining jazz, espionage, and colonialism in Africa with a free screening of Soundtrack to a Coup d'Etat on Wednesday, April 30, 6:30 p.m. at Seekers Church, 276 Carroll Street Northwest, steps away from the Tacoma Park Metro. The evening concludes with a panel discussion. Seating is limited, so registration is required. Details at Eventbrite and then searching Friends of the Congo. WPFW, building a better world, one broadcast at a time.
Code Pink, Women for Peace is coming to you live from Washington, D.C. and New York City, Thursday at 11 a.m. Code Pink Radio is an energizing new program focused on ending wars and militarism and building a peace economy. Listen weekly to robust conversation and inspiration from grassroots peacemakers from places like Korea, Yemen, Venezuela, Palestine, and Iran, as well as peacemakers in our nation's capital who are confronting war hawks in the White House and in Congress and modeling the actions we want our government to take. Again, that's Code Pink Radio, Thursdays at 11 a.m. on Washington, D.C.'s WPFW and New York City's WBAI, an engaging hour of cutting-edge conversation not to be missed.
We are women of the world. We're from the east, south, north, and west.
Hi, this is Robin Holden.
And this is Miyuki Williams.
WPFW is celebrating its 48th year, April 25th, 6:30 p.m. at Martin's Crosswinds.
Vocalist Navasha Dea will perform, and James Funk will be on the ones and twos.
Longtime programmer Vaughn Martin, artivist Ayanna Gregory, and civil rights activist Dr. Joyce Ladner and Latoisha Brown, all of them will be honored that night.
Zain El Amin and Esther Iverum will share poetry.
It'll be an evening of community, music, poetry, and dancing with the WPFW family.
Tony Carr, Bill Wax, Kamal Harris, Craig Williams, Roach and Martine Brown, Tim Masters,
Violetta Diamond, Joni Eisenberg, Kim Bay, Verna Avery Brown, Ida Campbell, just to name a few of the programmers who will be hosting tables.
Details at WPFWFM.org.
WPFW commemorates the birthday of James Joseph Brown on May 3rd from 7 a.m. to midnight. Revolution of the Mind, Unpacking the Genius and Torment of James Brown, will feature his music, delve into his complicated and tumultuous family history and sometimes troubling behavior, and celebrate his artistic, entrepreneurial, and activist legacy, including James's live performances in Ghana, Zambia, and Zaire, present-day DRC. That's Revolution of the Mind, unpacking the genius and torment of James Brown, Saturday, May 3rd, 7 a.m. to midnight on WPFW, building